Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Indie Business Radio for Monday, September 14th, 2009. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and you have arrived at the one place where we empower you to enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way. Well, we had a Labor Day break in between my last show and this one, and I got to tell you, I am moving a little bit slow to get everything up and running because I had such a great vacation. It's amazing how taking 1 week off the show, changes my whole rhythm. But here I am. I'm back, and I'm so excited, and I am just delighted to have as my guest today, Sramana Mitra. She is the author of Bootstrapping, Weapon of Mass Reconstruction. This is a second in a series of books under the Entrepreneur Journeys title, which is a fantastic collection of Sramana's thoughts and ideas, experiences, interviews with people in the trenches bootstrapping their businesses. Sramana Mitra is a technology entrepreneur and strategy consultant in Silicon Valley. She has founded three companies and writes a business blog, Sramana Mitra on Strategy. She has a master's degree in electrical engineering and computer science from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and she is also a business columnist for Forbes. Welcome to the show, Sramana.
Thank you, Donna. Nice to be here.
Now, this book covers bootstrapping, and we all kind of, in a broad sense, know what bootstrapping is. But for those of us who may just be getting introduced to the concept of it with that terminology used, tell us what you mean by bootstrapping a business.
So what I mean by bootstrapping, Donna, is that doing a business or getting a business off the ground with very little or no external financing.
And that pretty much sums it up for a lot of small business owners and certainly the ones who are listening to this show.
That's right. That's most of the business that is created in the world. Definitely in America, but most of the business that's created in the world is created without any external financing. So that pretty much sums up, I would say, probably 90% of all businesses or more.
Well, it also sums up at least 90% of our listeners. So for those of you who are listening at indiebusinessradio.com, make sure you turn your volume up and choose the player that's best for you on your computer. You can also join us in our chat. And to get to the chat is really easy. Just go to twitter.com/indiebusiness and click on the link, which is in my last tweet, to join the live chat. You may have some questions about bootstrapping your business, and Sramana is an expert at it, and so she's here to answer those questions. So, Sramana, one of the things that's really interesting about a portion of your book is your discussion of the fact that over 90% of businesses are bootstrapping, but it doesn't look like the federal government is kind of recognizing that. And the Obama administration, and not just him, but others in the past, are not doing a really good job of embracing the notion that so many people are bootstrapping businesses. Tell us what you mean by that and what you think we might be able to do to change that.
Well, I think what President Obama has done, I do think he has good intentions, but I think he hasn't really been able to get the right advisors around him who have a good understanding of bootstrapping. So he has a lot of, venture capitalists around him, very, very well-known venture capitalists are on his advisory council. There are other people on the advisory council that come from big business. But I don't think he has the voice of the bootstrapping entrepreneur represented very well in his administration and in his advisory council. And that's why he cannot possibly understand the nuances and the details and the intricacies of a bootstrap business, because he's never been a business person himself. He's never built anything from a business perspective, so it's not expected that he would understand. But he hasn't also, as a result, he has not been able to get the right advisors around him, and that's what's preventing him from understanding the needs of your listeners and the bootstrapping entrepreneurs in general.
Well, Sramana, it's interesting because at one point in time, for a short period of time, I think it was in the Clinton administration, the Small Business Administration head was actually in the president's cabinet. And I think the commentary I've seen says that it really didn't do much good. But I guess that depends on your perspective. But nevertheless, it only lasted for a few months. I'm not sure how long, but it was less than a year. Do you, in your experience working with small business owners, do you think that something like that could make a difference?
You know, I have actually a slightly different idea about what would make a difference, because this president and this administration is so internet savvy and so at least makes the case that they really want to listen to the voice of the people of America. I think what would help is if people started writing to the president, talking about what their needs are. And WhiteHouse.gov has a you know, if you go into the contact button in WhiteHouse.gov, you can actually write directly to the White House staff. So my suggestion would be, rather than trying to do it through a cabinet position, which is less, I think there is less predictability on what's going to happen on that front. I think there's a very nice opportunity for lots of bootstrapping entrepreneurs to actually write directly to the president and the administration and make them aware of the issues.
That's a good suggestion. And, you know, I wonder why it hasn't happened. Do you have a theory on that, or maybe what could be done to encourage it? I think everybody I know who has a business would say that's a great idea. I love the sound of that, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. What do you think on the ground level, on the practical level, small business leaders can do to make this happen?
I think we should all kind of at some level get together and start coming up with like a set of recommendations of what can be done, what are the needs of the bootstrapped entrepreneurs, and send that over to the president. So I think it's a question of a better uniform message. Randomly just saying that, oh, President Obama, you need to do something for the bootstrapped entrepreneurs may not help, which is kind of why I wrote the book and gave it the title I did. I could have given it a slightly different title, saying, like, doing more for less. In fact, the book is coming out in India as doing more for less, but I purposely gave it the bootstrapping weapon of mass reconstruction title here in America, because I wanted the policymakers to be aware of how important this is right now.
That's a really good point. One of the things at the beginning of your book, one of the introductory sections is called Fund Envy. And I think that's a really interesting thing to think about. Shramana, is it fairly new in the history of American business that more often than not businesses are bootstrapping as opposed to looking for outside funding?
No, I think most businesses in America got built without external financing, without venture capital. But in between, I would say right around when the internet boom hit the market, I would say in the mid-90s, until about recently, let's say in the last 15 years or so, venture capital has come to be known as an unduly important vehicle, I would say. There was venture capital available in much greater proportions, much greater amounts than before for this period of time. And the, all the academic institutions, business schools and so forth, have started teaching, you know, when they teach entrepreneurship, they start teaching venture capital. And they don't teach bootstrapping. So the irony of all this is that the educators do not understand the value of bootstrapping.
Is that in large part because many of them, as you said earlier, they don't have a business and they've never managed one?
To some extent, yes.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. So are there opportunities for entrepreneurs who have successfully bootstrapped a business to move into the educational field and make some changes in that area?
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. I don't know if you've seen what I'm doing in the mentoring entrepreneurs area. I have these strategy roundtables that I do twice a month, and these are online strategy roundtables, and 1,000 people from anywhere in the world can attend them, and I listen to entrepreneurs' pitches and give them feedback on their strategy, and very often there is a discussion on bootstrapping. I just wrote my Forbes column on new ways to mentor entrepreneurs last week on Friday about this experiment, and it's been a very successful experiment.
Tell us more about the roundtable discussion. Can we log in? Can anyone log into that?
Anyone can log in. You just have to register, and it's a It's done on a web conferencing platform called Dimdim, and you basically, anybody can dial into the phone number and log into the web conference, and five entrepreneurs per session pitch me their ideas. I give them real-time feedback, and that's that feedback spans from their market strategy to financing strategy to all over the place, and includes lots of discussion on bootstrapping very often. And it's something that 1,000 people can listen to, ask chat questions, just like you're doing with your session here. It's a very effective way of developing knowledge.
That sounds fantastic. If we follow you on Twitter, will we get announcements about when those are scheduled?
You certainly will.
Great. So everyone, you heard that. You can follow her at Sramana on Twitter, S-R-A-M-A-N-A. So, you know, I love the stories that you share in this book. You have several stories of people that you've interviewed and shared their stories. And one of the most fun quotes and interesting quotes is one guy who bootstrapped his business and ultimately, you know, is just making a couple $1 million a year, and he's had some interesting ups and downs. But one of the things he said in the book was, you know, I see all these friends of mine who are getting all this money and getting funding, and I'm wondering what in the world they're doing with all this money. Scott Wehner of SysOpt and Reseller Ratings said that. Tell us a little bit about his story so my listeners can have an idea of what he did.
Boy, Scott Wehner is a really, really interesting story, because this guy was 15 years old when he started his first company. And within a very short time, he was making $100,000 a year. And at some point, he decided he went to college, but then very soon, very early on in college, he was making so much money and his business was, you know, already thriving. He basically went to his college counselors and said that I need to quit.
And it's funny, the book says that he didn't tell them how much money he was making because they would have thought that he was doing something illicit.
Yep, that's right. So then, and he went on to build a several million-dollar business, like in the dot-com era, his company got acquired, and then he went through all sorts of gyrations. But nonetheless, this is somebody who started off very young with very little money. There was no investment per se. He built that entire business with zero investment.
Right. I think your book says, except for an inordinate amount of his time.
This is a very important point. If you want to bootstrap a business, you are going to have to put in an inordinate amount of your time, because that's the trade-off. By putting in an inordinate amount of your time and your energy and your emotional energy, that's how you mitigate the need for a lot of financial resources. And I think you are much more creative and much more resourceful when you're doing it that way, just because everything matters, every little decision matters, and every little piece of creativity can make a big difference. And when you're under a very resource-constrained environment, you tend to be a lot more creative.
So let's talk, Sramana, in the few minutes we have before our break. Let's start a quick discussion to address people who are looking to bootstrap a business. They haven't started yet, but maybe they have a really good idea. What are some of the first things they need to do? I know that's such a broad question, but let's just assume that the idea is good and that, you know, the person has a computer and access to the Internet and all that stuff. What are some of the first things that they need to do to, you know, look at their bank account and say, there's nothing in it, but I have a lot of time. What do I do first?
What you need to do first is validate, test and validate. In fact, I just last week released the third volume of this Entrepreneur Journey series, which is called Positioning, How to Test, Validate, and Bring Your Idea to Market. And it takes you through a step-by-step process of a due diligence, what we call a due diligence exercise. And I would say, do not build anything. Let's say you're talking about a software business or an internet business or whatever. I would say a toy or a widget or whatever it is, don't build anything. To begin with, don't build anything. Validate, validate, validate. Test the idea. Talk to the potential customers and first get a good validation of your idea. before you build anything. And this is something that I've discussed in the bootstrapping book in plenty. There are two particular chapters that I will point you to in the bootstrapping book. One is the story of Greg Gianforte, who talks at length about how he validated his business idea. And he's making calls. He made some 400 phone calls, sometimes cold calls, to get feedback on his idea. To the right people. The right people is important. You have to identify the right people who can validate your idea. So by all means, read that Greg Gianforte story for specific details on how he did his validation step. Another very interesting discussion is with Murli Tirumali of Ocarina Network towards the end of the book. He talks about a process that he calls SDBS, Sell, Design, Build, Sell. So before you design or build anything, you first sell. So you sell first, see if the customer, the potential customer, is resonating with your idea, then you go design and build, and then you sell again to actually get the deal. But you first sell the concept, then you design, then you build, then you sell the product.
Wonderful advice. And it's so great that we can learn so much from the experiences, both good and bad, or difficult and challenging, I should say, because none of them are bad experiences, from entrepreneurs who have blazed a trail before us. And that's one of the things that's so great about this book, is those kinds of stories are there. We're going to take our first break. We're talking with Sramana Mitra, author of Bootstrapping, Weapon of Mass Reconstruction. This is Indie Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Why is everyone listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com? Because it's the future of talk radio. Every day, more and more people are finding internet radio as not just an alternative media, but as a replacement to traditional AM and FM broadcast stations. Internet radio offers a wider variety of programs, convenient on-demand listening that meets your schedule, and fewer commercial interruptions. And GlobalTalkRadio.com is already leading the way by matching this content with a highly targeted internet audience. GlobalTalkRadio.com offers its listeners one of the widest programming varieties on the internet, from business and finance to self-improvement, paranormal, health, literature, romance, politics, and more. There are also opportunities for prospective hosts who would like to host their own weekly or one-time talk shows. Want to learn more? Check us out at www.globaltalkradio.com and see the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. We're talking today with Sramana Mitra, author of Bootstrapping, Weapon of Mass Reconstruction. And before we took our break, Sramana was sharing with us the sell, design, build, sell idea. That is, first you sell your idea, then you design it, then you build it, and then you sell it for real. Sramana, tell us what you noticed about people who actually don't plan a business in that way. They kind of start doing something they enjoy, and then suddenly one day they wake up and go, huh, you know, I can make a business out of this. What sorts of things do they need to do that may be different from someone who's actually sitting down and saying, I'm going to start a business, I'm going to plan it before I launch it?
Well, if you're already in the middle of something, if you've already built something, and if you're already, on your way, you must have feedback. You know, there's something that has told you. If you started with an idea and you started building on that idea, and things started happening. So at some point, the point at which you said to yourself that, yeah, I think I have a business here, that means you've got market feedback. So pay attention to that market feedback and make it a more systematic process of collecting that market feedback in a more systematic way, so that you know really for a fact this is not an emotional decision or a pure instinctive decision. It's a decision, maybe the instinctive decision or emotional decision gets you going in that direction, but then you have to put in the real, you know, as I said, due diligence to see that, yeah, it really does make sense. So what I recommend you don't do is kind of purely work off an emotional decision. I think the emotions are incredibly important. I think you can only be an entrepreneur if you have a tremendous amount of emotion attached to your project or a successful entrepreneur, let's say, because without passion, without that emotional commitment and that emotional flow, I don't think it's possible to put in the amount of work it takes to build a venture.
So what are your tips on keeping those emotions in check, though? Because so many small business owners that I've seen, and also I'm guilty of this myself sometimes, we get so emotional and so excited about something that we're pursuing it before we sit down and go, wait a minute, is this a really good idea or is this something that I just really like?
That's where I would recommend that you use the processes and the methodologies that I have been putting out there, and that's the book that you are discussing, the Bootstrapping Weapon of Mass Reconstruction book, that takes you through some of that process, some of the due diligence process, and the positioning, how to test, validate, and bring your idea to market, gives you a checklist. There's an appendix, about a 5-6-page appendix, which takes you through the entire process of what questions you should be asking and how do you validate based on those questions. There's lots of case studies where I'm asking the entrepreneurs who have gone through the process already of how they have done their piece of it. So you'll learn a lot from other people's experiences. And then there's an appendix which gives you the checklist of how you do it on your own venture.
Ramona, what sorts of trends or interesting experiences did you notice in your interviews for entrepreneurs who happen to be women versus men? Are there any interesting differences there?
So I have, in the books, there are some examples of women, but I don't think I've necessarily seen a lot of, in the books at least, that's not where I focus, but I have very recently on my blog done a big series on mompreneurs, for instance.
And what sorts of things have you noticed? Are there any differences or things that moms need to deal with that fathers or men may not?
I think there is a slightly different motivations. A lot of the entrepreneurs I've seen there, they are looking for flexibility. You know, people come into entrepreneurship from many different directions with many different motivations. And I think in the mompreneurs, the research that we've done shows that people were looking more for flexibility because they were facing, a lot of people came out of corporate careers where they were really having a hard time, you know, juggling their careers and their children and family life, and they wanted more control over their situation. They wanted to be their own boss, and they wanted more flexibility of being able to do things in their own time. So I think motivation is one thing that I see is somewhat different in the mompreneurs versus in the, you know, more mainstream entrepreneurs.
And what are the more mainstream motivation? Is it basically money?
No, I don't think so. I think money is one. I think there is also the desire to build something big and something, you know, they have vision about something. They have vision about a technology or an industry or an idea, and it's I think it comes more from I guess the simple way to put it is the ego vision factors are more common in the mainstream entrepreneurs, whereas with the mompreneurs, the flexibility and the control over their time is a bigger factor.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And so when you talk with, again these bootstrapping startups, are you finding that they're frustrated by not having found venture capital, or are you finding more people just aren't even going there anymore?
I think that's a complex question. There is some of each. I think the mistake that people make, and this is something that I've addressed quite closely in the last two books, the bootstrapping book and the positioning book, is that there is an issue of market size that you have to keep in mind in deciding whether you want to bootstrap a business or you want to raise venture capital. Venture capital as a category of financing is only applicable if you have a business idea that is very large, and that by large I mean like $500 million plus market size. And that is a rare type of business idea. Most entrepreneurs do not have very large business ideas. They have small business ideas that are perfect for building small niche businesses like $5 million a year business, even $500,000 a year business or $20 million a year business, but all this falls in the category of small business. Even $20 million a year business, even though it sounds like it's a great business, is very small from the venture capital perspective. And that is a business that is not financeable by venture capital. So the formal term that we use in the venture capital world is TAM, Total Available Market. And if you do not have a TAM that is very large, you should not even try to go to raise venture capital because you do not qualify for the venture capital format. But that does not mean that you should not be building your business. If you can build, just think about it, if you can build a $15, $20 million a year or even $1 million a year business, bootstrapped, what is wrong with that? You can have a great lifestyle, you can have great cash flow, you can have a great team that, you know, that is happy doing what it's doing, and you have a great life. What, tell me, what is wrong with that?
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with it. Are you finding that mainstream business thinks there's something wrong with that?
No, but I think entrepreneurs get caught in this trap that unless they raise venture capital, they are not successful. This is a flawed assumption. This is a flawed thinking. And this I'm seeing is rampant in American business today. And it's true in global business. I get a lot of emails from Indian entrepreneurs, oh, we can't find financing. I'm like, why do you need financing? First explain to me why you need financing.
Yeah, because
starting from the wrong premise that you need financing.
Well, that's a good question. And then they can't answer, right, a lot of times?
And they can't answer.
Right.
And they can't answer.
Let's step back from venture capital financing and look at bank loans.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing in terms of people wanting to go that route as opposed to bootstrapping?
The problem with bank loans is that typically banks don't like to finance collateral-free. They don't like to do collateral-free financing. Now, most of the requirements of a venture are not really collateral-based requirements. They are working capital requirements. They're plain, you know, month-to-month, whether it's salary requirements or just, like, expenses requirements. They're not really big investments in machinery or property and stuff that can be collateralized. This is one of the key problems with bank financing, debt financing.
And then, you know, the next thing I see is just sort of moving from the progression from venture capital to bank loan. And that would include like a small business loan even through the SBA. The next thing I see, Sramana, is people looking for grants. There seems to be this idea that if I have a halfway decent business idea that I should be able to get a grant for it.
Again, why do you need all this?
Well, and that's a really good question. Let's explore that. Is that a mindset issue?
It is absolutely a mindset issue. Somehow, people think that, oh, if I had a little bit of financing, life would be easier and I can hide all my problems under the rug. Most people, if you really look into the kinds of, if you look at, we have this, again, a formal terminology called sources and uses of funds in a business plan, in a venture, investment proposal. Okay, so you are trying to raise $500,000. What is the use of that $500,000? Oh, it's salary. I want to pay myself. This is the problem. So but everybody is trying to raise money to pay themselves. This is not what entrepreneurship is all about.
Well, I love that you're saying that. I wonder if some of that mindset comes from, you know, the boom years before the recession that we're in, when money was just being thrown around all over the place and everybody thought they should have some, and most people got some if they asked.
Yeah, I did three ventures in the height of the internet bubble from 1994 all the way to 2000. I did three ventures, I was in Silicon Valley. You go in with a 5-slide PowerPoint presentation and you get a few million dollars without any due diligence. This is what has created the bad expectations, the entitlement feelings, and this bad habits.
So let's talk about what the micro businesses of today realistically can do. And one of the things your book talks about is how companies or individuals who are starting businesses that try to bypass or overlook or skirt around bootstrapping miss a lot of what is necessary to be successful. Tell us what you mean by that.
Can you paraphrase your question? Let me try to see if I got
it. Yeah, there's a section of your book. I've got it right here in front of me. I can't remember the page, but one of the things you talked about is that, you know, for companies that don't, you know, roll up their sleeves and sort of just dive in and deal with the issue of bootstrapping and enjoy that process, they're really missing out on a lot of the fun of being an entrepreneur.
The people who are being successful bootstrapping are missing out on the fun of being an entrepreneur, or people who are raising money who are being missing out on the fun of being an entrepreneur?
Well, let me read it. I just found it. It says, the book takes aim at a core issue missed by most entrepreneurship books, that bootstrapping is an essential route among the roadmap to startup success. I guess I was just using the word fun in place of startup success, because if your startup is successful, you're probably not.
Oh, okay, yes. So this is a multi-layered issue. One of the issues that people miss when they try to raise money very early on is that there is an issue of equity control. And this is people who have been around these venture-funded startup environments for many years know, or many cycles know, that the moment you raise money, you start giving up equity control.
Right.
If you raise money at a very low valuation, which you're bound to, if you raise money early, your valuation is going to be minuscule. And you're going to give away 40, 50, 60% of your company right away. And if the venture hits a bump, which all ventures do,
right.
I can tell you from experience, all venture hit bumps. The investors, when they get nervous, they'll fire you. So you just wiped out however many, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of your life that you've put into this venture just like that.
Right, and your book talks about at least one entrepreneur that actually happened to. He sold his business and eventually, shortly thereafter, got laid off. That's a really good point. We're going to come back after our final break and talk with author Sramana Mitra more. We're going to get into the specifics of bootstrapping a business, what things you need to do in order to make sure that the investment of your time pays off with a successful, profitable business. This is Indie Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Want to stay on top of what's new in the radio industry? Sign up for a free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio, available exclusively to listeners of globaltalkradio.com, and find out what's new in the world of online radio. Listeners can find out about new shows and special guests. People with something special to offer can find out how to become a guest and how to prepare for an interview. And prospective hosts will find a valuable resource for everything from planning their new program to selecting topics and guests, recouping expenses by selling advertising, and more. Sign up today for your free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio by visiting www.globaltalkradio.com and learn about the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. We're here this afternoon with Sramana Mitra, author of Bootstrapping, Weapon of Mass Reconstruction. So, Sramana, we've talked about a lot of these financial type issues, but for most of my listeners, we don't have a lot of financial issues because we don't have a lot of finances. So what are some of the practical things we need to do to hit the ground running to maximize the success of a bootstrap venture?
Well, you know, understanding in your private life is really important. I have covered this a little bit, if you remember, Donna, in the Manoj Saxena story. This is a guy who, when he decided that he was going to start his first company, basically went to his wife and said, "Well, you know, this is something I plan to do. I'm going to quit my job. Our income is going to go down to half of what it was because your income, his wife's income, is going to be the only income that they're going to bank on." And they needed to create some understanding on household chores and all sorts of things. So this is like just basic things. This guy basically called his wife his first venture capitalist, which I thought was really sweet. But you need kind of understanding with your spouse or whoever is in your private support system before you go out and do something like this, because it is going to have its own set of challenges, stress factors, and so forth. So you really need the support network to work really, really well. The rest of it is mechanics. You know, it's like really tight cash management, frugality. You know, I dedicated this book, the bootstrapping book, to my mother, who taught me a lot of very good financial discipline and frugality. I call frugality an enormous virtue in the entrepreneur's life. So those are good habits and disciplines that I think you should keep an eye on.
So in today's economy, I mean, a lot of people are not just choosing to leave jobs for the bootstrapping lifestyle or entrepreneurial lifestyle, but they're almost being forced to consider it as an option because the jobs are so scarce. Are you seeing people make that adjustment?
Absolutely. And I would say that, in a way, look at it not as being forced to do something, look at it as an opportunity opening up. Maybe you've been dreaming about having your own company for years and years and years, and you never did it because there was this paycheck that was coming and you were used to the perks of that paycheck. Well, if that paycheck stops, then that opportunity opens up, that life opportunity opens up. And think about it as an opportunity, not as being forced to do something, under pressure.
And, that sounds really good, but if someone's had a job all their life and all of a sudden they're forced into, I mean, I've been bootstrapping for a long time. It's the only way I've ever run my business. So for me, it's just not an issue. And if something happened to this one, I'd just bootstrap another one. But how do you help people who just, they've never even thought about it before?
They'll need to start thinking about it, Donna. The reason I say look at it as an opportunity is because you can grow tremendously through that process. So be very systematic in how you explore the process. And to some extent, you know, my first book actually in the Entrepreneur Journey series came out last October, which is right when the financial crisis was basically shit hitting the fan kind of situation. And I relentlessly talked to people who were losing jobs use a systematic format to understand how entrepreneurs work. My whole point of this series is to demystify entrepreneurship so that people who find themselves as entrepreneurs the first time or have chosen to become entrepreneurs the first time can really pick up the series of books and get a very first-hand feel, very first-hand flesh and blood, practical, pragmatic feel of what it is to be an entrepreneur and what are the mechanics, the step-by-step, block-by-block mechanics. Anything you don't understand, anything that you're ignorant about, becomes something that you're afraid of. As you start understanding it, it becomes less scary. It becomes like more inspiring, something that you can do.
And your books do a really good job of kind of breaking this kind of information down. So, Sharmana, if we're in this position, do we need to start with Volume 1?
Well, let me actually give you, a story from Volume 1, which I think you should read. It's called Bootstrapping to Billions. These are two entrepreneurs who bootstrapped their company to a $5 billion market cap. This is, of course, height of the dot-com, height of the telecom bubble. They were an optical computing company. What they did was they consulted, they kind of did contract work for other people, other companies, and that's how they've managed to get the cash with which on the side they built a product which became very successful. So they were both in touch with customers on a regular basis, learned what the customers' needs were, but they were also being paid by these customers to build something else. So it's what I'm saying is it is possible to build even very big companies, huge companies, by bootstrapping. And also, as you bootstrap and build companies up to a certain point, the chances of getting financing go up as you become a more validated, more proven business. So there are many different options. I would say start with Volume 1 and go through Volume 1, 2, and 3, and you will, I can guarantee you, you will come out of that exercise feeling a lot more confident about yourself. My whole point is to give you the tools with which you can feel confident about being an entrepreneur.
Sharmana, what is approximately the least amount of money that you've seen a bootstrapper use to start a business that has eventually become profitable?
$10,000.
$10,000. That's the least. Okay. So for people who don't have that much money, at least to start out with, are there some things that they can do if they have less than that to kind of try and...
$10,000 you can get on a credit card, I think.
Pardon?
$10,000 I think you can get on a credit card.
Okay, good. Well, there you go. You heard it right here. Well, you know, bootstrapping, as you describe it in the book, and as certainly we've seen it described before, requires, as you say, a great deal of time, but also, I mean, it really, I'm going to use the word force again, I'm sorry, forces you to be more creative than you've ever had to be in your life.
That's right, and I think that's a good thing.
It's a really good thing, and so for people who are saying, $10,000, I don't have that, well, one thing I'm sure that you would say is to, you know, not think about it as what you don't have, but look what you do have, and then just start brainstorming. Maybe come to some of your Dim Dim events, or just even talk with local entrepreneurs in your hometown.
Yeah, come to my Dim Dim events. I think you know what's going on in the Dim Dim events, and we've been doing it for almost a year now, and entrepreneurs from all over the world are coming to those events. You need to go to stromanamitra.com, and there's a tab in the top right corner called Roundtables, and you will find all the recordings there, and you'll find all the registration information there. We have twice a month roundtables. So I'd love to have you there, and I'd love to have you take advantage of those sessions to learn all these nitty-gritty details of how you can bootstrap and how you can, you know, validate and all of these things that you need to know to be a successful entrepreneur.
What sorts of things would you recommend people consider if they're thinking about bootstrapping a business with a partner, with another person?
Understanding. You have to set the expectations very clearly of what is the responsibility of each of the partners and what are the ownership factors, what are the contributions and everything. It's just like a huge amount of communication and putting a legal framework around it, because who knows what happens in the course of a venture. You spend, you know, 5 years working together, and maybe 5 years later you want to part. You should have it very clearly laid out in your initial documentation that how the ownership is split up and how you can terminate that relationship if it's necessary. And it also make it much easier to work together as long as all those understandings are in place. Nothing is ambiguous, nothing is fluid.
And I guess getting them in place before there's a disagreement makes it easier to use them to get yourself moved forward from a difficult situation. Stromana, what do you, you've been working with bootstrappers for many years now. How have you noticed that digital technology changes have impacted bootstrappers' ability to be successful? I'm talking about social media and social networking.
Oh, incredibly, incredibly. Just building businesses today has become so much cheaper, because everything from, you know, setting up a business, computers cost very little money, servers cost very little money, hosting services cost very little money, and then the marketing, getting the word out, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or, you know, various blogs and this and that. You can start a blog of your own at the drop of a hat. This has all become so much easier, you know. Before the internet, all this was so much more expensive, so much harder.
For people that are on the front end of bootstrapping, Stromana, in terms of social networking, I mean, you talked about sell, design, build, sell, and that involves on the front end doing your research and validating your idea. Can a business owner with what they think is a good idea actually start doing that and just use the internet, use a blog, use some networking?
Yes, absolutely. LinkedIn, for instance, is a great service where lots of professionals are out there and their resumes are out there as well. So if you're trying to, you know, contact certain types of professionals, if your business is selling to professionals, selling to business people or certain businesses, that LinkedIn is a very good way. If it's selling to consumers, you find the right social media that caters to the right consumer type. You know, if it's something you want to sell to moms, then go find the mommy bloggers and the, you know, mommy social media networks and go do your market research that way. So there, I mean, every category of consumer has a social media property at this point, so, or, you know, social media hub. So Yes, it has become enormously easier to do all this on the internet.
And so you find where your target customers are, and you go hang out with them. You don't even have to let anybody know that you're doing market research.
That's right. You develop relationships, you start talking to people, and you automatically find out things.
Relationships. That's a really big part of it, isn't it?
Everything in business is about relationships, Donna. Humongous, whether it's relationships with your customers, relationships with your investors, partners, everything. There's a huge amount of relationship factor in this. Relationship with the media. Business is hugely about relationships.
So tell me a little bit about, in our last couple of minutes, what you have found to be most effective for bootstrappers to gain some positive media attention.
Again, relationships with the right, media people. So, I think depending on what kind of target audience you're trying to get to, find the set of really influential media opinion makers for that particular segment, and you can do all sorts of things. A very common thing that I allow people to do on my blog, if it's somebody coming to me to want to reach my audience, which is a technology business audience,
mm-hmm.
largely, I would let them do guest columns, for instance, for free. So I will give them access to my audience, and if they have an interesting point of view, something interesting to write about, I will let them write guest columns. So guest blogging has become a very effective way of accessing audiences that typically people who run blogs will let you do.
That's a really great suggestion, and so you can find where your audience, the blog that your audience reads, and invest some time understanding that blog and how it works and what the audience looks for, and then send a pitch to the editor of the blog.
Yeah, so I would say just hang out in that community, in that blog,
right.
Write comments and have discussions with the audience of that blog. That's one way to start getting to know the community and getting to know the editors of those blogs or writers of those blogs. And then at some point, I think if you have developed enough of a track record or enough of credibility and you make your point that this is something I want to write about, this is who I am, this is why I'm qualified to write about this, very often the editors will let you guest blog.
And maybe relieved, too, because it means they don't have to think about something to blog about one day.
yes.
Yeah, and what you're describing is in practical terms, that's where the time comes in. And ultimately, those relationships can be worth far more than capital investment in your business anyway.
Yeah.
That's really good advice.
No amount of capital investment is going to, let you tap into a blog's audience. The only way you can do that is by engaging in a relationship mode of the way I described.
That's right. That's
no
right.
amount of capital is going to help you there.
Right. So there's a difference then between doing that. What if you could take a bunch of money that you get and go buy an ad? But that's not a bad thing. But
ads are nowhere near as effective as PR.
It's totally different.
If you want ads to be effective, you have to spend so much money. I would say, as a cardinal rule, do not use advertising. Advertising is a wastage of money unless you're Apple and you can spend, hundreds of millions of dollars.
All right. Well, that's interesting. And
the only
then,
kind of advertising that does pay is the search engine marketing advertising. Search engine ads pay.
Great. And then I suppose there are certain types of advertising you can do in some communities where you're actually a part of the community. Can that play off of each other well?
Maybe. I would say largely try PR, not advertising. PR is much more effective than advertising for small businesses.
Good. And then the tips that you've provided, you can create your own PR, right? It's not like you have to go out and hire somebody or engage the services of a professional to do this. You can use social media, as you suggested, and kind of be your own PR person.
That's also true.
Good ideas. Well, I love those tips. I love those suggestions, and you have provided such encouraging and helpful information for our bootstrappers here today. Sramana, tell us, where should we go to get more of you? Do you do speaking? Can we go here? You speak somewhere? Or where do we go to get more of you?
I think the first first place where you would find me is at sramanamitra.com, sramanamitra.com. And whatever I'm doing, whether it's roundtables or speaking or columns that I've written somewhere else, which is my Forbes columns, everything is indexed in my blog. So if you want to keep track of what I'm doing and how to, you know, engage with me, that's the best place.
Well, that makes it really easy, and you can also follow Sramana on Twitter at twitter.com/SRAMA, and we will be able to get you in touch with her there. Well, Sramana, thank you so much for joining. It's been a real pleasure to have you. I'm looking forward to finding out more about the things that you do. Next week, my guest is going to be Eric Quammen, author of Socialnomics, How Social Media Transforms the Way We Live and Do Business. That's next week, right here on Indie Business Radio. I'll see you then. In the meantime, enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.